Theater of the Mind.
Last month, and in a previous episode, I mentioned having a passing interest in military history. Like others, I have the advantage of both safety and 20/20 hindsight in studying events and situations I would never want to actually be present for. In the chaos, fear, and confusion that blankets all participants in battle, it's impossible to see the complexity and multi-layered nature of war. The people on the ground tend to experience a much simpler and more stripped-down version of reality, consisting of only a few principal objectives, not the least of which is simply staying alive. While it's a fascinating topic to mull over, I have to admit feeling somewhat guilty at times over that sense of cool detachment from the personal horror of violent conflict. It's easy to have an opinion when all of your life's accomplishments and struggles, hopes and dreams, loves, hurts, laughter, and legacies aren't precariously balanced on a tiny fulcrum measuring 7.62 millimeters across and whizzing through the air at 2,000 feet per second along with thousands of others just like it. The war movie has been popular for decades, and its bastard civilian child, the action movie, is arguably the biggest draw at the box office. The horror film, awash with savage monsters and brutal murderers, comes in a very close second. The military-industrial complex has shown that death and violence are a huge industry, but the simulation of it for entertainment purposes has proved to be no less lucrative, and hundreds if not thousands of books and treatises have been written on the possible reasons why. Most seem to agree that one element of it is a human need to vicariously and safely experience the things we fear. Somehow, the theory goes, our anxieties undergo a sort of exorcism when we willingly suspend our disbelief and emotionally invest ourselves in the fear, suffering, and death of a fictitious stranger while experiencing no danger of our own. It sounds like a ghoulish indictment of human nature to put it into such callous and selfish terms, but it is what it is, and I freely admit to being guilty of it, and so are you. If you weren't, you wouldn't be listening to this, because you're a haunter. The more pedestrian, run-of-the-mill Halloween reveler may be content to see Halloween as an opportunity to dress up as a caricatured president or pornographic Easter bunny and go bar hopping on the 31st or the nearest available Saturday night. But haunters are the creators of dark kingdoms where fear and horror are the law of the land and death is the monarch upon its pale throne. I've danced around this topic for about 4 years now without hitting it head-on, but I've been wanting to address the use of violence in the imagery of the haunt. People can be pretty polarized in their opinions on the topic, and most everyone has perfectly valid reasons for their stance. Death and the threat of death or violence are pretty much universal thematic elements in the haunting world. That's actually kind of a no-brainer. Most haunts have scares, or at least a palpable atmosphere of fear, and so some sort of threat must be at least implied. It all comes down to how far you want to run with it in terms of detail and intensity. And that is ultimately determined by what role violence plays in the story you're trying to tell. Is it an ingredient or the primary focus of the show? It might be a good idea to give this some thought. When deciding on the level of violent content in a haunt, probably the biggest audience-based factor that needs to be taken into consideration is the age of the audience. The general rule of thumb is, the younger the children, the less graphically violent the content should be. Granted, it's a different world now than what it was 60 years ago. Once a kid gets through the fifth grade nowadays, they've pretty much seen it all just from television, let alone video games and the internet. But with the very young, it's important to consider not just the intensity of the imagery itself, but also the fact that the haunt is an immersive environment and not just a 2D representation on a screen. The intensity is cranked up a great deal by being in the thick of things in real life. How many adults in their 20s and 30s do you see cringing and cowering as they make their way through the haunt? Now, take that same anxious person and make them 6 years old. Big difference. Scary things are just a lot scarier when you're quite small. But perhaps one of the most critical vulnerabilities of children has nothing to do with physical size. It's about brain development and psychology. Rational, objective thought, what we would call critical thinking, is only fully possible in the later stages of brain development. Toddlers and slightly older children are aware of their surroundings and capable of complex thought, but their day-to-day mental activity spends a lot more time in what we would call the subconscious mind. There's no critical factor there, and fantasy and reality haven't yet fully separated. Children's gradual acceptance of the unreality of mythology and fantasy is less a factor of experience than it is the basic ability to form critical thought. Before that time comes, a very young child in an interactive threat scenario is going to more or less experience it as if the threats were real. directly threatening the child or siblings or parents with graphic violence can actually be pretty traumatic. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not one of these Oprah-fied pop psych pansies riding the childhood trauma pony with constant references of being scarred for life over every little thing. Kids are pretty resilient, and they'll figure out that it's all a game. But, and this is just a personal opinion here, it's still Halloween, which kids look forward to because it's fun. And if a little kid gets truly terrified that people are actually being killed, and thus by extension, threatening them and their loved ones, it can take all the fun out of it and ruin the kid's Halloween, which just strikes me as being kind of mean. I'm just putting it out there. It's your call. This doesn't necessarily mean having to build a strictly kiddie haunt. The scare and no scare group approach, or the no mercy after 8 p.m. disclaimer, are still options if your crowd is mixed. One of the biggest debates in horror, whether it be in a haunt or in a movie or TV show, revolves around blood. It's hard to imagine a haunt without blood of any sort, or Halloween for that matter. When I was in grade school, that was one of the first things you bought in October was that little squeezed tube of vampire blood. When decorating and putting together those first crude versions of haunts, the red paint always came out. It didn't even need to have any logical purpose where you painted it. There just needed to be drippy red blood patterns running down things, and that made it Halloween. The complaints, however, seem to come rolling in more when the blood, and distribution thereof, starts looking more real. When it's painted on in static, drippy rivulets down a surface, that's usually taken in stride. That's a pretty standard graphic arts version of blood that's almost synonymous with Halloween decor. When it's splattered across the wall, it starts to look a bit more extreme. A body lying in a pool of blood on the floor, and the scene is perceived to be pretty violent. Jetting out of someone's slashed neck, well, that one's pretty obvious. The more realistic the scene is, and the more obvious the violence of the act that brought the blood about, the more of an impact the blood will have. Even if a body on the floor is covered by a sheet, and you can't see the body, if that sheet is red-soaked, it's going to be considered a pretty graphic scene. This isn't so much an issue if you're running a pro haunt, which mostly gets teens and adults, but could raise some eyebrows from parents if it's a neighborhood haunt frequented by young kids. Also, the color of the blood makes a real difference. Standard red paint looks pretty flat and unrealistic, and thus you can get away with a lot more. But there are some fairly expensive high-end two-part paint formations out there that mimic the exact color and shine of real blood, and that stuff will get a reaction. Going the opposite way, I've seen advertisements, both printed and video, for movies in which very bloody scenes were color adjusted so that the blood would show unrealistically dark or even black. Surprisingly, those pictures sometimes looked even better than the actual scene in the movie. The black drips and spatters just looked somehow even more disturbing than the expected red would have. Food for thought. Another factor that feeds into the perceived violence of a scene is the identity of the villain. A werewolf standing over a mangled body gives a different impression than a crazed person with a knife. Paranormal monsters aren't real, so carnage scenes featuring them are perceived more as fantasy. But an identifiable person slaughtering someone is an undeniable display of not merely threat, but of sadism and cruelty, and a similar scene is seen as more violent because of it. Bringing things closer to home brings a much darker and more negative tone to a horror scene. Even a scene with an ordinary animal like a family pet turned murderous is extra disturbing, because people can picture it happening to them on any given day, and have probably read about it or seen it on the news at some point within the last few months. The identity of the victim also plays into how the scene is perceived. One thing that's always sort of bothered me in the horror industry, both Hollywood and Halloween, is the disproportionately high number of female victims. This has led to many activists and detractors of cinematic horror to complain that the industry is misogynistic and run by bullies who delight in feeding smaller and weaker prey to their predators. In reality, the reason for the prevalence of female victims is actually somewhat the opposite. Studies have shown that the sound of a female scream elicits a greater emotional response in people because it triggers a guardian instinct. Since women and children, as a general rule, are more physically vulnerable to harm, over the millennia, humans as a species have become hardwired to go into a full state of alarm at their cries of distress. So the traditional reliance on the damsel in distress, or dismemberment, depending on how far the scene goes, is not a celebration of cruelty towards women, but simply a dirty trick intended to trigger our natural protective response. This is all great in theory, but I've found many people to be even more agitated by a male scream because it's something you rarely hear. Men are more accustomed to shouting in anger or challenge than in fear, so it may be very well that the rational mind is equating the helpless terror of a grown man with an even scarier and more dangerous threat. If you want to feature a villain or beast in your haunt that is truly to be feared, there's something to be said about one that's not afraid to pick on someone its own size. All things considered, it's almost a foregone conclusion that violence and untimely death, or the aftermath of them, will play some role in many, if not most, haunts. How much emphasis it receives is entirely up to the haunter's tastes and sense of propriety with respect to the audience. Movies and haunts run the gamut from whimsical ghost story to torture porn, and the haunter should decide ahead of time in what direction he or she wants to take it. If a haunter has put a lot of time and effort into creating a good story and ambiance, it would do well to make sure all elements of the haunt are balanced so that they're all fully appreciated. If you went into overtime establishing a creepy soundtrack and atmosphere of foreboding, all sense of those will be wiped from the audience's perception if you then saturate the haunt with gore and screaming victims, and a lot of effort will go unnoticed. It's like taking a complexly and delicately seasoned meal and drowning it in ketchup. One of the most successful horror thrillers of all time was Halloween, and there was very little actual violence and almost no blood in it. Movies like Cabin Fever and Hostel may have made a big splash when they came out, but they have all but dried up and faded away in the shadow of giants like The Exorcist and Nightmare on Elm Street, which had much more to offer than just blood and suffering. Violence is a pretty potent seasoning. A little goes a long way. And if a lot is used throughout indiscriminately, it will completely dominate the overall flavor and become the primary impression. A good chef gets the recipe in order before the kitchen opens. Knock 'em dead. And of course, keep the ghost light burning. From the Theater of the Mind, I'm Revenant, and you're listening to Hauntcast.
I'm going now. Heaven help you.
Please like and follow the podcast. Stalk us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Links in the description. And help us by sharing Hauntcast with all your haunted Halloween brethren. Until next time, stay scary.